you will find prosperity. So I endorse any network marketing organization that is first committed to developing you as a human being, more than developing you into a salesperson. I would seek organizations that have successful track records, a distribution system and a compensation plan that has been successful for years, a business opportunity you can succeed with, believe in, and share confidently with others, ongoing long-term educational programs to develop you as a human being. Self-confidence is vital on the right side of the quadrant, as well as a strong mentor program. You want to learn from leaders, not advisors. People who are already leaders on the right side of the quadrant and want you to succeed. And finally, I'd choose an organization that has people you respect and enjoy being with. If the organization meets these criteria, then and only then look at the product. A system is a bridge to freedom. Being homeless was not an experience I want to repeat. Yet for Kim and me, the experience was priceless. Today, freedom and security are found not so much in what we have, but what we know we can create with confidence. Since that time, we have created or helped develop a real estate company, an oil company, a mining company, and two education companies. So the process of learning how to create a successful system was beneficial for us. Yet I would not recommend the process to anyone unless they truly want to go through it. Until only a few years ago, the possibility of a person becoming successful in the B quadrant was only available to those who were brave or rich. Kim and I must have been brave because we certainly weren't rich. The reason so many people stay stuck in the left side of the quadrant is because they feel the risks involved in developing their own systems are too great. For them, it is smarter to remain safe and secure in a job. Today, primarily due to changes in technology, the risk in becoming a successful business owner has been greatly reduced, and the opportunity to own your own business system has been made available to virtually everyone. Franchises and network marketing took away the hard part of developing your own system. You acquire the rights to a proven system, and then your only job is to develop your people. Think of these business systems as bridges. Bridges that will provide a path for you to cross safely from the left side to the right side of the cash flow quadrant. Your bridge to financial freedom. The seven levels of investors. My rich dad once asked me, "What is the difference between a person who bets on horses and a person who picks stocks?" "I don't know," was my response. "Not much," was his answer. "Never be the person who buys the stock. What you want to be when you grow up is the person who creates the stock that brokers sell and others buy." For a long time, I did not understand what my rich dad really meant. It was not until I started teaching investing to others that I really understood the different types of investors. A special thanks goes to John Burley, an authority in real estate and a fellow teacher. He developed the original six levels of investors, which I have modified over the years. See if you recognize anyone you know. Using this identification method in concert with the cash flow quadrant will allow you to understand the world of investors and learn how you can change your own attitudes and investment future. Level 0. Those with nothing to invest. These people have no money to invest. They either spend everything they make or spend more than they make. There are many rich people who would fall into this category because they spend as much or more than they make. Unfortunately, this zero level is where about 50% of the adult population would be categorized. Level 1. Borrowers. These people solve financial problems by borrowing money. Often they even invest with borrowed money. Their idea of financial planning is robbing Peter to pay Paul. They live their financial lives with their heads in the sand like ostriches, hoping and praying that everything will work out. While they may have a few assets, the reality is that their level of debt is simply too high. For the most part, they are not conscious about money and their spending habits. Anything they own of value has debt attached to it. They use credit cards impulsively and then roll that debt into a long-term home equity loan so they can clean up their credit cards and then start charging again. If the value of their homes goes up, they borrow on the equity again or buy larger and more expensive homes. They believe the value of real estate only goes up. The words low-down, easy monthly payments has always drawn their attention. They often purchase depreciating toys or doodads such as boats, swimming pools, vacations, and cars with those words in mind. They list these depreciating toys as assets and go back to the bank for another loan and wonder why they get turned down. Shopping is their favorite form of exercise. They buy things they don't need, saying to themselves, "Oh, go ahead, you deserve it," or "You're worth it," or "If I don't buy it now, I may never find it again at such a great price." They think spreading debt over a long period of time is smart, always kidding themselves that they'll work harder and pay off their bills someday. They spend everything they make and then some. If they have money, it gets spent. If they don't have the money, they borrow it. When asked what their problem is, they will say they just don't make enough money. They think more money will solve the problem. No matter how much they make, they only get deeper into debt. They fail to see that the problem is not necessarily income or lack of it, but rather their money habits. They often argue with loved ones about money, emphatically defending their need to buy this or that. They live in complete financial denial, pretending that miraculously their money problems will someday disappear, or they pretend they will always have enough money to spend on whatever they desire. This level of investor can often look rich. They may have big houses and flashy cars, but if you check, they buy on borrowed money. They may also make a lot of money, but they are one professional accident away from financial ruin. Level 2. Savers. These people put aside a small amount of money, usually, on a regular basis. The money is in a low-risk, low-return vehicle such as a money market checking account, savings account, or certificate of deposit, CD. If they have an individual retirement account, IRA, they have it with a bank or in a mutual fund cash account. They often save to consume rather than to invest, saving for a new TV, car, vacation, etc. They believe in paying in cash. They are afraid of credit and debt. Instead, they like the security of money in the bank. Even when shown that in today's economic environment, savings give a negative return after inflation and taxes, they are still unwilling to take on much risk. Little do they know that the U.S. dollar has lost 90% of its value since 1950 and continues to lose value annually at a greater rate than the interest a bank pays them. They often have whole life insurance policies because they love the feeling of security. People in this group often waste their most precious asset, which is time, trying to save pennies. They spend hours clipping coupons from the newspaper, and then at the supermarket, they hold up everyone else in line, fumbling to find those big savings. Instead of trying to save pennies, they could have put that time into learning how to invest. If they had put $10,000 into John Templeton's fund in 1954 and forgotten about it, it would have been worth $2.4 million in 1994. Or if they'd put $10,000 into George Soros's quantum fund in 1969, it would have been worth $22.1 million in 1994. Instead, their deep need for security, which is fear-based, keeps them saving in low-yield investments, such as bank CDs. You often hear these people saying, "A penny saved is a penny earned," or "I'm saving for the kids." The real truth is that there is often some deep insecurity running them in their lives. In truth, they often shortchange themselves and the people they are saving for. They are almost the exact opposite of the level one investor. It is good to have some savings. It is recommended that you have 6 months to a year's worth of living expenses held in cash. But after that, there are far better and safer investment vehicles than money in the bank. To hold your money in the bank earning 5% while others are getting 15% and more is not a wise investment strategy. One painful lesson I experienced as a young boy was simply how much time one dad had available to spend with me versus the other. As the success and prominence of both dads grew, it was obvious that one dad had less and less time to spend with his wife and four children. My real dad was always on the road, at meetings, or dashing off to the airport for more meetings. The more successful he got, the fewer dinners we had together as a family. Weekends he spent at home in his crowded little office, buried under paperwork. My rich dad, on the other hand, had more and more free time as his success grew. One of the reasons I learned so much about money, finance, business, and life was simply because my rich dad had more and more free time for his children and me. Although both dads made more and more money as they became successful, my real dad, the educated one, also got further into debt. So he'd work harder and suddenly find himself in a higher income tax bracket. His banker and accountant would then tell him to buy a bigger house for the so-called tax break. My dad would follow the advice and buy a bigger house, and soon he was working harder than ever so he could make more money to pay for the new house, taking him even further away from his family. My rich dad was different. He made more and more money but paid less in taxes. He too had bankers and accountants, but he was not getting the same advice my highly educated dad was getting. Yet the driving force that would not allow me to stay on the left side of the quadrant was what happened to my highly educated but poor dad at the peak of his career. In the early 1970s, I was already out of college and in Pensacola, Florida, going through pilot training for the Marine Corps, on my way to Vietnam. My educated dad was now the superintendent of education for the state of Hawaii and a member of the governor's staff. One evening, my dad phoned me in my room on base. "Son," he said, I'm going to resign from my job and run for lieutenant governor of the state of Hawaii for the Republican Party. I gulped and then said, You're going to run for office against your boss? That's right, he replied. Why? I asked. Republicans do not have a chance in Hawaii. The Democratic Party and the labor unions are too strong. I know, son. I also know that we do not have a prayer of winning. Judge Samuel King will be the candidate for governor, and I will be his running mate. Why? I asked again. Why run against your boss if you know you're going to lose? Because my conscience won't let me do anything else. The games these politicians are playing disturb me. Are you saying they're corrupt? I asked. I don't want to say that, said my real dad. He was an honest and moral man who rarely spoke badly about anyone. He was always a diplomat. Yet I could tell from his voice that he was angry and upset when he said, I'll just say that my conscience bothers me when I see what goes on behind the scenes. I could not live with myself if I turned a blind eye and did nothing. My job and paycheck are not as important as my conscience. After a long silence, I realized that my dad's mind was made up. Good luck, I said quietly. I'm proud of you for your courage, and I'm proud to be your son. My dad and the Republican ticket were crushed, as expected. The re-elected governor sent the word out that my dad was never to get a job again with the government for the state of Hawaii, and he never did. At the age of 54, my dad went looking for a job, and I was on my way to Vietnam. At middle age, my dad went from jobs with big titles and low pay to more jobs with big titles and low pay. He was a tall, brilliant, and dynamic man who was no longer welcome in the only world he knew. He tried starting several small businesses, and even bought a famous franchise, but they all failed. As he grew older and his strength slipped away, so did his drive to start over again. His lack of will became even more pronounced after each business failure. He was a successful E employee, trying to survive as an S, self-employed, a quadrant in which he had no training or experience and for which he had no heart. He loved the world of public education, but he could not find a way to get back in. He died frustrated and a little angry, yet he died with a clear conscience. So what kept me going in the darkest of hours? It was the haunting memory of my educated dad sitting at home waiting for the phone to ring, trying to succeed in the world of business, a world he knew nothing about. That, and the joyous memory of seeing my rich dad grow happier and more successful as his years went on, inspired me. Instead of declining at age 54, rich dad blossomed. His years of methodically building businesses and investing were paying off, and he was on his way to becoming one of the richest men in the islands. The cash flow quadrant is more than two lines and some letters. If you look below the surface, you will find completely different worlds as well as different ways of looking at the world. As a person who has looked at the world from both the left side of the quadrant and the right side, I can honestly say the world looks much different depending on which side you are on. One day over lunch, I talked to my rich dad about my educated dad. Your father and I are not the same people at the core, said rich dad. While we are both human beings, we both have fears, doubts, beliefs, strengths, and weaknesses. We respond or handle those core similarities differently. How we respond to those differences is what causes us to remain in one quadrant or another. When your dad tried to cross over from the E, employee quadrant, intellectually he could understand the process, but he couldn't handle it emotionally. When things did not go smoothly and he began to lose money, he did not know what to do to solve the problems. So he went back to the quadrant he felt most comfortable in. The E and sometimes S quadrant, I said. Rich Dad nodded his head. When the fear of losing money and failing becomes too painful inside, a fear we both have, he chooses to seek security, and I choose to seek freedom. Even though we're all human beings, when it comes to money and the emotions attached to money, we all respond differently. And it's how we respond to those emotions that often determines which quadrant we choose to generate our income from. Different quadrants, different people, I said. That's right, said Rich Dad. And if you're going to be successful in any quadrant, you need to know more than just technical skills. You also need to know the core differences that cause people to seek different quadrants. Know that, and life will be much easier. Step 4. Decide what kind of investor you want to be. Most people struggle financially because they avoid financial problems. One of the biggest secrets my rich dad taught me was that if you want to acquire great wealth quickly, take on great financial problems. In addition to the seven levels of investors, I would like to add one more distinction that defines the three different types of investors. There are Type A, or investors who seek problems. Then there are Type B, or investors who seek answers. Finally, there are Type C, or what I call Sergeant Schultz investors. I know nothing. Let me address these types of investors in reverse order. Type C investors. The name Sergeant Schultz comes from the lovable character in the TV series Hogan's Heroes. When he knows something is wrong, all Schultz says is, "I know nothing." Most people, when it comes to investing, take the same attitude. Can Sergeant Schultz investors still achieve great wealth? The answer is yes. They can get a job with the federal government, marry someone rich, or win the lottery. Type B investors often ask such questions as, "What do you recommend I invest in? Do you think I should buy real estate? What mutual funds are good for me?" Type B investors should immediately interview several financial planners, choose one, and start taking their advice. Financial planners, if they're good, provide excellent technical knowledge and can often help you establish a financial game plan for your life. Type A investors look for problems. In particular, they look for problems caused by those who get into financial trouble. Investors who are good at solving problems expect to make returns of 25% to infinity on their money. They are typically level 5 and level 6 investors who have strong financial foundations. Can you be all three types of investors? In reality, I operate as all three types of investors. I am a Sergeant Schultz or a Type C investor when it comes to mutual funds or picking stocks. I do have a few mutual funds, but I really do not spend much time studying them. I can achieve better results with my apartment houses than with mutual funds. As a Type B investor, I seek professional answers to my financial problems. I seek answers from financial planners, stockbrokers, bankers, and real estate brokers. They are closer to the market and are, I trust, more up to date with changes in the laws and the markets. The advice of my financial planner is priceless simply because she knows trusts, wills, and insurance far better than I ever will. Everyone should have a plan. There is much more to investing than simply buying and selling. Years ago, my rich dad encouraged me to develop my skills as a business owner and investor. He also said, "Then practice solving problems." For years, that is all I've done. I know that inside of every problem lies an opportunity, and opportunities are what real investors are after. Step 5. Seek mentors. Mentors tell us what is important. Find somebody who's been there, and choose your mentors wisely. My highly educated but poor dad thought that a job with a high salary was important, and that buying the house of your dreams was important. He also believed in paying bills first and living below your means. My rich dad taught me to focus on passive income and spend time acquiring the assets that provided passive or long-term residual income. Both dads served as strong mentors for me as I grew up. The fact that I chose to follow the financial advice of my rich dad did not lessen the impact that my educated but poor dad had on me as well. I would not be who I am today without the strong influence of both these men. Step 6. Make disappointment your strength. Be prepared to be disappointed. Rich Dad often said, "Only fools expect everything to go the way they want." Expecting to be disappointed is a way of mentally and emotionally preparing yourself to be ready for surprises that you may not want. By being emotionally prepared, you can act with calm and dignity when things do not go your way. If you're calm, you can think better. Try new things and expect disappointment, but always have a mentor standing by to coach you through the experience. And be kind to yourself. We all make mistakes. We all feel upset and disappointed when things do not go our way. Yet the difference lies in how we internally process that disappointment. Tell the truth. The future belongs to those who can change with the times and use personal disappointments as building blocks for the future. The key to this step is to take action. Reading, watching, and listening are all crucial to your education, but you must also start doing. Step 7. The power of faith. Even though you may not be good at everything, take time developing what you need to learn and your world will change rapidly. Never run from what you know you need to learn. Face your fears and doubts, and new worlds will open to you. Using these 7 steps, my wife and I were able to move from being homeless to being financially free in a few short years. I trust they can assist you in charting your own course to financial freedom. To do that, you need to be true to yourself. If you are not yet a long-term investor, get yourself there as fast as you can. Sit down and take control of your spending habits. Minimize your debt and liabilities. Live within your means, and then increase your means. The reason I've introduced you to the cash flow quadrant is to offer you different glimpses into who you are, what your interests may be, and who you ultimately may become. Anyone can find his or her own unique path to the financial fast track, regardless of which quadrant they operate from. Yet it is up to you to find your own path. Remember, your boss's job is to give you a job. It's your job to make yourself rich. In the end, you must mind your own business. Once you make that commitment, life really does get easier and easier. Minding your business is not hard to do. It's just common sense. Believe in yourself and start today on your path to financial freedom. This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of Rich Dad's Cash Flow Quadrant, written by Robert T. Kiyosaki, with Sharon L. Lecter, CPA, and read by Jim Ward. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Arthur G. Insana. Text abridged by Harriet Greenberg and edited by William Whittington. Production coordinated by Dennis Kao. Engineered, edited, and mixed by John Kovarik. Rich Dad's Cash Flow Quadrant is also available in paperback from Warner Business Books. Level 3. Smart Investors. There are three different types of investors in this group. This level of investor is aware of the need to invest. They may even participate in the company retirement plan, 401k, SEP, superannuation, pension, etc. Sometimes they even have outside investments in mutual funds, stocks, bonds, or limited partnerships. Generally, they are intelligent people who have a solid education. They make up the two-thirds of the country we call the middle class. However, when it comes to investing, they are often not educated or lack what the investment industry calls sophistication. Rarely will they read a company annual report or company prospectus. How could they? They were not trained to read financial reports. They lack financial literacy. They may have advanced college degrees and may be doctors or even accountants, but few have ever been formally trained and educated in the win-lose world of investing. These are the three main categories in this level, specifically those who can't be bothered, those who are cynics, and those who are gamblers. They are often smart people who are well-educated and often make substantial incomes, and they do invest, yet there are differences. Of the group that can't be bothered, they have convinced themselves they don't understand money and never will. They say things like, I'm just too busy, or it's just too complicated, or investing is too risky. These people just let the money sit and do little in their retirement plan or turn it over to a financial planner who recommends diversification. They block their financial future out of their minds, work hard day to day, and say to themselves, at least I have a retirement plan. When they retire, then they'll look at how their investments did. The second category is the cynic. These people know all the reasons why an investment will not work. They are dangerous to have around. They often sound intelligent, speak with authority, are successful in their chosen fields, but are really cowards under their intellectual exterior. They can tell you exactly how and why you will get swindled with every investment known to man. When you ask for their opinions on a stock or other investment, you walk away feeling terrible, often afraid or doubtful. Their most commonly repeated words are, well, I've been taken before. They're not going to do that to me again. Yet, strangely, these same cynics often follow the market like sheep. At work, they're always reading the financial pages or the Wall Street Journal. They read the paper and then tell everyone else what they know at the coffee break. They talk about the big deals, but are never in them. They look for stocks that make the front page, and if the report is favorable, they often buy. The problem is they buy late, because if you get your news from the newspaper, it is too late. The truly smart investors have bought way before it makes the news. The cynic does not know that. When bad news comes, they criticize and say things like, I knew it. They think they're in the game, but they're really only spectators standing on the sidelines. They often want to get into the game, but deep down they are terribly afraid of getting hurt. Security is more important than fun. Cynics are often what professional traders call pigs. They squeal a lot and then run to their own slaughter. They buy high and sell low. Why? Because they're so smart they have become overly cautious. They are smart, but are terrified of taking risks and making mistakes, so they study harder, get smarter. The more they know, the more risk they see, so they study even harder. Their cynical caution causes them to wait until it's too late. They come to market when greed finally overpowers their fear. They come to the trough with the other pigs and get slaughtered. But the worst part about cynics is that they infect the people around them with their deep fear, disguised as intelligence. When it comes to investing, they can tell you why things won't work, but they can't tell you how they could work. It is possible to get rich quickly with little money and with little risk. It is possible, but only if you are willing to do your part to make it possible. One of the things you need to do is keep an open mind and beware of cynics as well as con men. They are both financially dangerous. The third category of this level is the gambler. This group is also called pigs by professional traders. But while the cynic is overly cautious, this group is not cautious enough. They look at the stock market or any investment market about the same way they look at a Las Vegas craps table. It's just luck. Throw the dice and pray. This group has no set trading rules or principles. They want to act like the big boys, so they fake it until they make it or lose it all. The latter is most probable. They are searching for the secret to investing, or the holy grail. They are always looking for new and exciting ways to invest. Instead of long-term diligence and study and understanding, they seek tips or shortcuts. They jump into commodities, initial public offerings, IPOs, penny stocks, gas and oil, cattle, and every other investment known to mankind. They like to use sophisticated investment techniques, such as margins, puts, calls, and options. They jump into the game without knowing who the players are and who makes up the rules. These people are the worst investors the planet has ever known. They always try to hit a home run. They usually strike out. When asked how they are doing, they are always, oh, about even or a little bit up. In actuality, they have lost money, lots of money, often huge amounts of money. This type of investor loses money over 90% of the time. They never discuss their losses. They only remember the killing they made 6 years ago. They think they were smart and fail to recognize they were merely lucky. They think that all they need is the one big deal and then they'll be on easy street. Society calls these people incurable gamblers. Deep down, they are simply lazy when it comes to investing money.
Here's a sample from the audio bestseller Rich Dad, Poor Dad. What the rich teach their kids about money that the poor and middle class do not. Written by Robert T. Kiyosaki with Sharon L. Lecter, CPA.
Dad, can you tell me how to get rich?
My dad put down the evening paper.
Why do you want to get rich, son?
Because today Jimmy's mom drove up in their new Cadillac and they were going to their beach house for the weekend. He took three of his friends, but Mike and I weren't invited. They told us we weren't invited because we were poor kids.
They did? My dad asked incredulously.
Yeah, they did, I replied in a hurt tone. My dad silently shook his head, pushed his glasses up the bridge of his nose, and went back to reading his paper. I stood waiting for an answer. The year was 1956. I was 9 years old. By some twist of fate, I attended the same public school where the rich people sent their kids. We were primarily a sugar plantation town. The managers of the plantation and the other affluent people of the town, such as doctors, business owners, and bankers, sent their children to this school, grades 1 to 6. After grade 6, their children were generally sent off to private schools. Because my family lived on one side of the street, I went to this school. Had I lived on the other side of the street, I would have gone to a different school with kids from families more like mine. After grade 6, these kids and I would go on to the public intermediate and high school. There was no private school for them or for me. My dad finally put down the paper. "Well, son," he began slowly, "if you want to be rich, you have to learn to make money." "How do I make money?" I asked. "Well, use your head, son," he said, smiling. Which really meant, "That's all I'm going to tell you, or I don't know the answer, so don't embarrass me." The next morning, I told my best friend Mike what my dad had said. As best I could tell, Mike and I were the only poor kids in this school. Mike was like me in that he was in this school by a twist of fate. Someone had drawn a jog in the line for the school district, and we wound up in school with the rich kids.
"So what do we do to make money?" Mike asked.
"I don't know," I said. "But do you want to be my partner?" He agreed. And so on that Saturday morning, Mike became my first business partner. We spent all morning coming up with ideas on how to make money. Finally, that afternoon, a bolt of lightning came through our heads. It was an idea that Mike had gotten from a science book he'd read. Excitedly, we shook hands, and the partnership now had a business. For the next several weeks, Mike and I ran around our neighborhood, knocking on doors and asking our neighbors if they'd save their toothpaste tubes for us. With puzzled looks, most adults consented with a smile. Some asked us what we were doing, to which we replied, "We can't tell you. It's a business secret."
Rich Dad, Poor Dad is also available in paperback from Warner Business Books.
What are the differences? How do I tell if people are an E, S, B, or I without knowing much about them? One of the ways is by listening to their words. A person who comes from the E or employee quadrant might say, "I am looking for a safe, secure job with good pay and excellent benefits." A person who comes from the S or self-employed quadrant might say, "My rate is $35 per hour," or, "My normal commission rate is 6% of the total price," or, "I can't seem to find people who want to work and do the job right," or, "I've got more than 20 hours into this project." A person operating out of the B, or business owner, quadrant might say, "I'm looking for a new president to run my company." Lastly, someone operating out of the I, or investor, quadrant might say, "Is my cash flow based on an internal rate of return or net rate of return?" Words are tools. Once my rich dad knew who the person he was interviewing was at the core, at least for that moment, he would know what that person was really looking for, what he had to offer, and what words to use when speaking to him. Rich Dad always said, words are powerful tools. If you want to be a leader of people, then you need to be a master of words. One word may excite one type of person, while that same word would completely turn off another person. For example, the word risk might be exciting to a person in the I, investor quadrant, while evoking total fear to someone in the E, employee quadrant. He would say, "Hear their words, feel their souls." Because behind the words a person chooses are the core values and core differences of that individual. When I hear the word secure or benefits, I get a sense of who the person might be at the core. The word secure is a word often used in response to the emotion of fear. If a person feels fear, then the need for security is often a commonly used phrase for someone who comes predominantly from the E, employee quadrant. When it comes to money and jobs, there are many people who simply hate the feeling of fear that comes with economic uncertainty, hence the desire for security. The word benefit means people would also like some kind of additional reward that is spelled out, a defined and assured extra compensation, such as a health care or retirement plan. The key is that they want to feel secure and see it in writing. Uncertainty does not make them happy. Certainty does. For them, the idea of security is often more important than money. The S, self-employed, want to be their own bosses, or they like to do their own thing. Often, when it comes to the subject of money, a hardcore S, self-employed, does not like to have his or her income be dependent on other people. Those who are self-employed do not like having the amount of money they earn dictated by someone else, or by a group of people who might not work as hard as they do. They also understand that if they do not work hard, then they don't deserve to be paid much. When it comes to money, they have fiercely independent souls. So while the employee often will respond to the fear of not having money by seeking security, the S, self-employed, will often respond by taking control of the situation and doing it on their own. When it comes to fear and financial risk, they want to take the bull by the horns. In this group, you find well-educated professionals who spend years in school, such as doctors, lawyers, and dentists. Also in the S, self-employed group are people who took educational paths other than, or in addition to, traditional school. In this group are direct commission salespeople, real estate agents, small business owners, restaurateurs, consultants, therapists, hairstylists, and artists, to name a few. Self-employed people are often hardcore perfectionists. And that is why we hire them. If you hire a brain surgeon, you want that brain surgeon to have had years of training and experience. But most importantly, you want this brain surgeon to be a perfectionist. The same goes for a dentist, hairstylist, marketing consultant, plumber, lawyer, or a corporate trainer. You, as the client hiring this person, want someone who is the best. For this group, money is not the most important thing about their work. Their independence, the freedom to do things their way, and to be respected as experts in their field are much more important than mere money. Many S, self-employed types, are hesitant to hire and train other people because once trained, they often end up as their competition. This in turn keeps them working harder and doing things on their own. The B, business owner, could almost be the opposite of the S, self-employed. Those who are true Bs like to surround themselves with smart people from all four categories. Unlike the S, self-employed, who do not like to delegate work because no one could do it better, the true B likes to delegate. The true motto of a B is, why do it yourself when you can hire someone to do it for you and they can do it better? Henry Ford fit this mold. My rich dad's idol was Henry Ford. He had me read books about people like Ford and John D. Rockefeller, the founder of Standard Oil. Rich Dad constantly encouraged his son and me to learn the essence of leadership and the technical skills of business. There is a science to business and leadership as well as an art to business and leadership. For me, both are lifelong studies. Leadership, Rich Dad said, is the ability to bring out the best in people. So he trained his son and me in the technical skills necessary to become successful in business. Technical skills such as reading financial statements, marketing, sales, accounting, management, production and negotiations. And he really stressed that we learn to work with and lead people. Rich Dad always said, the technical skills of business are easy. The hard part is working with people. Level 4. Long-term investors. These investors are clearly aware of the need to invest. They are actively involved in their own investment decisions. They have clearly laid out long-term plans that will allow them to reach their financial objectives. They invest in their education before actually buying an investment. They take advantage of periodic investing and, whenever possible, invest in a tax-advantaged way. Most importantly, they seek out advice from competent financial planners. If you are not yet a long-term investor, get yourself there as fast as you can. What does this mean? This means that you sit down and map out a plan. Get control of your spending habits. Minimize your debt and liabilities. Live within your means and then increase your means. Find out how much invested per month for how many months at a realistic rate of return it will take to reach your goals. Goals such as, at what age do you plan to stop working? How much money will you need per month? Simply having a long-term plan that reduces your consumer debt while putting away a small amount of money on a periodic basis into a top mutual fund will give you a head start on retiring wealthy, if you start early enough, and keep an eye on what you're doing. At this level, keep it simple. Don't get fancy. Forget the sophisticated investments. Just do solid stock and mutual fund investments. Learn how to buy closed-end mutual funds soon if you haven't already. Don't try to outsmart the market. Use insurance vehicles wisely as protection, but not as wealth accumulation. A mutual fund like the Vanguard Index 500 Fund, which in the past has outperformed two-thirds of all mutual funds year in and year out, is worth using as a benchmark. Over 10 years, this type of fund may give you a return that exceeds 90% of the professional mutual fund money managers. But always remember, there is no 100% safe investment. Index funds have their own inherent tragic flaws. Stop waiting for the big deal. Get into the game with small deals, like my first small condo that allowed me to start investing for just a few dollars. Don't worry about being right or wrong at first. Just start. You'll learn a lot more once you put some money down, just a little to start. Money has a way of increasing intelligence quickly. Fear and hesitation retards you. You can always move up to a bigger game, but you can never get back the time and education you lost by waiting to do the right thing or make the big deal. Remember, small deals often lead to bigger deals, but you must start. Start today. Don't wait. Reduce your credit card debt. Get rid of doodads and call a good no-load mutual fund, although there is no such thing as a true no-load fund. Sit down with your loved ones and work out a plan. Call a financial planner or go to the library and read about financial planning and start putting money away, even if it's only $50 a month for yourself. The longer you wait, the more you waste one of your most precious assets, the intangible and priceless asset of time. An interesting note, level 4 is where most of the millionaires in America come from. For people who don't like risk and would rather focus on their profession or career instead of spending a lot of time studying the subject of investing, Level 4 is a must if you want to live a prosperous and financially abundant life. For these individuals, it is even more important to seek the advice of financial planners. They can help you develop your investment strategy and get you started on the right track with a long-term investing pattern. This level of investor is patient and uses the advantage of time. If you start early and invest regularly, you can make it to phenomenal wealth. If you start late in life, past age 45, this level may not work, especially between now and the year 2010. The difference between an S type of business and a B type of business is those who are true Bs, business owners, can leave their business for a year or more and return to find their business more profitable and running better than when they left. In a true self-employed type business, if the S left for a year or more, the chances are there would be no business left to return to. So what causes the difference? Saying it simply, an S, self-employed, owns a job. A B, business owner, owns a system and then hires competent people to operate the system. Or, put another way, in many cases the S, self-employed, is the system. That is why they cannot leave. To be successful as a B, business owner, requires ownership or control of systems and the ability to lead people. For S's, self-employed, to evolve into B's, business owners, they need to convert who they are and what they know into a system, and many are not able to do that, or they are often too attached to the system. Many people come to me for advice on how to start a company or ask me how to raise money for a new product or idea. I listen, usually for about 10 minutes, and within that time I can tell where their focus is. Is it the product or the system of business? In those 10 minutes, I most often hear words such as these. Remember the importance of being a good listener and allowing words to direct you to the core value of a person's soul. This is a far better product than company XYZ makes. I've looked everywhere and nobody has this product. I'll give you the idea for this product. All I want is 25% of the profits. I've been working on this product, book, music score, invention for years. These are the words of a person generally operating from the left side of the quadrant, the E, employee, or S, self-employed side. Since I need to be gentle at this time, because we are dealing with core values and ideas, at this point of the conversation, I often use the McDonald's hamburger example for clarification. I slowly ask, can you personally make a better hamburger than McDonald's? So far, 100% of the people I've talked with about their new idea or product have said yes. At this point, I ask them the next question. Can you personally build a better business system than McDonald's? Some people see the difference immediately, and some do not. And I would say the difference is whether the person is fixated on the left side of the quadrant, which is focused on the idea of the better burger, or on the right side of the quadrant, which is focused on the system of business. I do my best to explain that there are a lot of entrepreneurs out there offering far superior products or services, but only McDonald's has the system that has served billions of burgers. The reality is, there are unlimited new ideas, billions of people with services or products to offer, millions of products, and only a few people who know how to build excellent business systems. Bill Gates of Microsoft did not build a great product. He bought somebody else's product and built a powerful global system around it. The I, investor, makes money with money. They do not have to work because their money is working for them. The I, investor quadrant, is the playground of the rich. Regardless of which quadrant people make their money in, if they hope someday to be rich, they ultimately must come to the I quadrant. It is in the I quadrant that money becomes converted to wealth. The cash flow quadrant simply makes distinctions on how income is generated. If you are an E, employee, you have a job. If you are an S, self-employed, you own a job. But if you own a system and people work for you, you are a B, business owner. And finally, if you are an I, investor, your money works for you. A few years ago, I read an article that said most rich people received 70% of their income from investments, or the I, investor quadrant, and less than 30% from wages, or the E, employee quadrant. And if they were an E, employee, the chances were they were employees of their own corporation. For most everyone else, the poor and the middle class, at least 80% of their income comes from wages from the E, employee, or S, self-employed quadrants, and less than 20% from investments, or the I, investor quadrant.
Here's a sample from audio bestseller Rich Dad's Guide to Investing, What the Rich Invest in That the Poor and Middle Class Do Not, written by Robert T. Kiyosaki with Sharon L. Lecter, CPA.
Investor lesson number one, the choice. When it comes to money and investing, People have three fundamental reasons or choices for investing, Rich Dad said. They are to be secure, to be comfortable, or to be rich. Rich Dad went on to say, all three choices are important. The difference in one's life occurs when the choices are prioritized. He explained that most people make their money and investment choices in that exact order. In other words, their first choice when it comes to money decisions is security. Second is comfort, and third is to be rich. That is why most people make job security their highest priority. After they have a secure job or profession, then they focus on comfort. The last choice for most people is to be rich. Rich Dad said, most people dream of becoming rich, but it is not their first choice. He went on to say, only 3 out of 100 people in America are rich because of this priority of choices. For most people, if becoming rich disturbs their comfort or makes them feel insecure, they will forsake becoming rich. That is why so many people want that one hot investment tip. People who make security and comfort their first and second choices look for ways to get rich quick that are easy, risk-free, and comfortable. A few people do get rich on one lucky investment, but all too often, they lose it all again. I often hear people say, I'd rather be happy than rich. That comment has always sounded very strange to me, since I have been both rich and poor, and in both financial positions I have been both happy and unhappy. I wonder why people think they have to choose between happiness and being rich. When I reflect upon this lesson, it occurs to me that what people are really saying is that I'd rather feel secure and comfortable than be rich. That is because if they felt insecure or uncomfortable, they were not happy. For me, I was willing to feel insecure and uncomfortable in order to be rich. I have been rich and poor as well as happy and unhappy. But I assure you that when I was poor and unhappy, I was much unhappier than when I was rich and unhappy. I have also never understood the statement, money does not make you happy. While there is some truth in it, I've always noticed that when I have money, I feel pretty good. The other day I found a $10 bill in my jeans pocket. Even though it was only $10, it felt great finding it. Receiving money has always felt better than receiving a bill for money I owe. At least that is my experience with money. I feel happy when it comes in and sad when it leaves me. That day, I put my priorities in this order. First, to be rich, then to be comfortable, and finally, to be secure.
Rich Dad's Guide to Investing is also available in paperback from Warner Business Books.
Although my wife and I were millionaires by 1989, we were not financially free until 1994. There is a difference between being rich and being wealthy. By 1989, our business was making us a lot of money. We were earning more and working less because the business system was growing without any more physical effort on our part. We still needed to convert the cash flow coming from the business into even more tangible assets that would generate additional cash flow. We had grown our business into a success, and it was time to focus on growing our assets to the point where the cash flow from all our assets would be greater than our living expenses. By 1994, the passive income from all of our assets was greater than our expenses. Then we were wealthy. The definition of wealth is the number of days you can survive without physically working, or anyone else in your household physically working, and still maintain your standard of living. For example, if your expenses are $1,000 a month, and if you have $3,000 in savings, your wealth is approximately 3 months or 90 days. Wealth is measured in time, not dollars. By 1994, my wife and I were wealthy indefinitely, barring great economic changes, because the income from our investments was greater than our monthly expenses. Ultimately, it is not how much money you make that matters, but how much money you keep and how long that money works for you. Regardless of how much money people make, ultimately they should put some in the I, investor quadrant. The I, investor quadrant, deals specifically with the idea of money making money, or the idea that your money works so that you do not have to work. Yet it is important to acknowledge that there are other forms of investing. People invest in their education. Traditional education is important because the better your education, the better your chances of earning money. You can spend 4 years in college and have your income earning potential go from $24,000 a year to $50,000 a year or more. Given that the average person spends 40 years or more actively working, 4 years worth of college or some type of higher education is an excellent investment. Loyalty and hard work is another form of investing, like being a lifelong employee of a company or the government. In return, via contract, that individual is rewarded with a pension for life. That is a form of investment popular in the industrial age, but obsolete in the information age. Other people invest in having large families, and in turn have their children care for them in their old age. That form of investing was the norm in the past. Yet due to economic constraints in the present, it is becoming more difficult for families to handle the living and medical expenses of parents. Government retirement programs, such as Social Security and Medicare in America, which are often paid for through payroll deduction, is another form of investment mandated by law. But due to massive changes in demographics and costs, this form of investment may not be able to keep some of the promises it has made. And there are independent investment vehicles for retirement that are called individual retirement plans. Often, the federal government will offer tax incentives to both the employer and employee to participate in such plans. In America, one popular plan is the 401k retirement plan, and in countries such as Australia, they are called superannuation plans. Although all of these are forms of investing, the I, investor quadrant, focuses on investments that generate income on an ongoing basis during your working years. In other words, is your money working for you and generating current income for you? Let's look at a person who buys a house as an investment and rents it out. If the rent collected is greater than the expenses to operate the property, that income is coming from the I, investor quadrant. The same is true for people who receive income as interest from savings or dividends from stocks and bonds. So the qualifier for the I, investor quadrant, is how much income you generate from the quadrant without working for it. Besides the obvious advantages of knowing how to make money with money and not having to get up and go to work, there are also many tax advantages that are not available to people who have to work for their money. One of the reasons the rich get richer is because they sometimes can make millions and legally not pay taxes on that money. That's because they make money in the asset column, not in the income column. Or they make money as investors, not workers. Level 5. Sophisticated investors. These investors can afford to seek more aggressive or risky investment strategies. Why? Because they have good money habits, a solid foundation of money, and also investment savvy. They are not new to the game. They are focused, not usually diversified. They have a long track record of winning on a consistent basis, and they've had enough losses that give them the wisdom that only comes from making mistakes and learning from them. These are the investors that often buy investments wholesale rather than retail. They put their own deals together for their own use, or they are sophisticated enough to get into deals that their capitalist friends, the Level 6 group, have put together that need investment capital. What determines whether people are sophisticated? They have a financial base that is sound from their profession, business, or retirement income, or have a base of solid conservative investments. These people have their personal debt-equity ratios in control, which means they have much more income than expenses. They are well-educated in the world of investing and actively seek new information. They are cautious, yet not cynical, always keeping an open mind. They risk less than 20% of all their capital in speculative ventures. They often start small, putting a little money down so they can learn the business of investing, be it stocks, a business acquisition, a real estate syndication, buying foreclosures, etc. If they lost this 20%, it would not damage them or take food off their tables. They will look at the loss as a lesson, learn from it, and get back into the game to learn more, knowing that failure is part of the process of success. While hating to lose, they are not afraid of losing. If people are sophisticated, they can create their own deals with returns of 25% to infinity. They are classified as sophisticated because they have the extra money, a team of hand-picked professional advisors, and a track record to prove it. These investors know that bad economic times or markets offer them the best opportunities for success. They get into markets when others are getting out. They usually know when to get out. At this level, an exit strategy is more important than entry into the market. They are clear on their own principles and their rules of investing. Their vehicle of choice might be real estate, discounted paper, businesses, bankruptcies, or new issues of stocks. While they take risks greater than the average person, they abhor gambling. They have plans and specific goals. They study on a daily basis. They read the paper, read magazines, subscribe to investment newsletters, and attend investment seminars. They actively participate in the management of their investments. They understand money and know how to have money work for them. Their main focus is on increasing their assets, rather than investing so they can make a few extra bucks to spend. They reinvest their gains to build a bigger asset base. They know that building a strong asset base that throws off high cash yields or high returns with minimal tax exposure is the path to great long-term wealth. They often teach this information to their children and pass on the family fortune to the generations that follow in the form of corporations, trusts, and partnerships. They personally own little. Nothing is found in their names for tax purposes, as well as for protection from Robin Hoods who believe in taking from the rich to give to the poor. But although they own nothing, they control everything to corporations. They control the legal entities that own their assets. They have a personal board of directors to help them manage their assets. They take advice and learn. This informal board is comprised of a team of bankers, accountants, attorneys, and brokers. They spend a small fortune on solid professional advice, not only to increase their wealth, but also to protect their wealth from family, friends, lawsuits, and the government. Even after they have departed this life, they are still controlling their wealth. These people are often called stewards of money. Even after death, they continue to direct the fate of the money they created.
Here's a sample from Rich Dad's Rich Kid, Smart Kid, giving your children a financial head start. The latest book from the New York Times best-selling authors Robert T. Kiyosaki and Sharon L. Lecter, CPA.
When I was a little boy, my rich dad often said, "Money is an idea." He would go on to say, "Money can be anything you want it to be. If you say, 'I'll never be rich,' then the chances are you'll never be rich. If you say, 'I can't afford it,' then chances are you can't." My smart dad said much the same about education. Is it possible that every child is born with the potential to be rich and smart? This program is about fostering and preserving that possibility. Both my dads were great teachers. Both men were smart men. But they were not smart in the same subjects, and they did not teach the same things. Yet as different as they were, both dads believed the same things about all kids. Both dads believed all kids are born smart and all kids are born rich. They both believed a child learns to be poor and learns to believe that he or she is less smart than other kids. Both dads were great teachers because they believed in bringing out the genius that each child is born with. In other words, they did not believe in putting knowledge in. They believed in bringing the child's genius out. Both my dads were great teachers because they rarely tried to cram their ideas into my head. They often said very little, waiting instead for me to ask when I wanted to know something. Or they asked me questions, seeking to find out what I knew, rather than simply telling me what they knew. And not to forget the moms. My mom was a great teacher and role model also. She was my teacher for unconditional love, kindness, and the importance of caring for other people. I once heard that boys marry women just like their moms, and I would say that is true for me. My wife Kim is also an extremely kind and loving person. I did not know my best friend Mike's mom very well. Yet the times I was over at their home, Mike's mother was also very kind and attentive to what we were doing. Although a very private person, she was always interested in what Mike and I were learning at school and in the business. I could tell she was a great life partner for Mike's dad. Although I did not know her very well, I learned from her the importance of listening to others, letting others talk, and being respectful of the ideas of others, even if they clash with your ideas. She was a great communicator in a very quiet way. Lessons from my mom and dad. The number of single-parent families I see today concerns me. Having both a mom and a dad as teachers was important in my development. My dad would often say, "True intelligence is knowing what is appropriate rather than what is simply right or wrong." As a 6-year-old boy, I learned from my mom that I needed to be kind and gentle. But when I found myself constantly confronted by bullies at school, I also learned that I could at times be too kind and gentle. I hated being called fatty and dumbo. Consequently, after talking with my dad, I learned to be strong and to stand up for myself. But there had to be balance. My father told me that many people live in a black-and-white world, or a right-and-wrong world. Many say, "Don't push back," and some say, "Push back." The key to being successful in life is, if you must push back, you need to know exactly how hard to push. When I got pushed or put down, I learned exactly how hard to push back. Knowing exactly how hard to push requires much more intelligence than simply saying, "Don't push back," or "Push back." My dad would often say, "True intelligence is knowing what is appropriate rather than what is right or wrong." I think today we need to be more intelligent with our strengths and our weaknesses. It used to be, when I was a kid, and I got angry with another guy at school, we would begin to wrestle, get tired, and then the fight would be over. The worst that happened was an occasional torn shirt or bloody nose. Today, kids get angry, start thinking in the less intelligent right and wrong mode, break out their guns and shoot each other.